I don't want to say I've seen it all because I haven't seen it all, but I'm really blessed that I've traveled the world since I'm 18. I went to every major auction in the world, every museum, and I've had so many fine things pass through my hands. But I got to tell you, I think I like more seeing that I can change somebody's life by telling them what they have, that they did not know that all along they've had sitting in that vault or sitting in that drawer under the socks, wherever they kept it, buried in the backyard. You know, there's the answer, you know, to their retirement, pay their mortgage off, send their kids to college, whatever it is. I truly love that experience.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. Way back in January, John Buse wrote a story about this Antiques Roadshow segment where a Paul Newman Daytona that had been purchased for $345 back in the 70s was now valued at hundreds of thousands of dollars, and the veteran owner almost passed out live on the show. The clip has since gone viral on YouTube, and based on the responses we got in the comments on the story, everybody found it just as crazy as we did. Since then, we were able to get in touch with a couple of the folks at Antiques Roadshow to get a little bit more of the story. So joining us today are executive producer Marsha Bemko and appraiser Peter Plains, two of the people instrumental in bringing this watch to light. They tell us all about how they found the watch, how they told the story, and what makes Antiques Roadshow such a special project for both of them. After that, we've got my conversation with Joe Thompson talking all things watch industry. As Joe describes it, it's a little bit like reporting on an earthquake in the middle of an earthquake, but we get into the state of the industry, what's going on with the trade shows, and a whole lot more. Joe's about as well-sourced as they come, and he's got some incredible information that I hadn't heard until we talked about it on air. So I learned a ton, and I think you're going to learn a ton too. The picture may not be the most optimistic, but there's still tons of time, and Joe gives us a pretty good sense of what might be on the horizon. So without further ado, let's get into it.
You explain to people when they see us that we haven't had a chance for a haircut for several weeks.
My COVID beard.
Do you give an explanation as to why we look like this?
You look great, Marsha. You actually look better. I don't know what you're doing, but you look better for some reason.
Thanks, Peter. You look dandy too. I like your beard.
Really?
Yeah, it looks good.
My sister says it makes me look old.
What a
I think it's cool. I think it's good.
I like it. Yeah. It makes you very hip.
Well, thank you guys both for joining us. I know there's a lot going on right now. It's a pretty crazy time, but it's nice that we could get together and do this. So thank you, Marsha and Peter, both for joining us today. It's really nice to have you guys.
Terrific to be with you, truly.
I figure we'll start off. I mean, I think our audience is all familiar with Antiques Roadshow, but I want to get a little background on each of you. Maybe Marsha, can you tell us a little bit about who you are, how you ended up working on Antiques Roadshow?
Geez, how did I end up working? It's a long story. I won't take you through all of it. I am Marsha Bemko. I'm the executive producer of Antiques Roadshow. What does that make me? It makes me the lead. I am the top lead in the show. I produce the show. And how did I get here? Well, we are about to tape season 25. God willing, we end up on tour this year. And I have been with us since we were taped season, well, right after we taped season 4. So I have been with Roadshow for 21 years. And, wow. And my job is, listen, it takes a team. It takes a massive team, actually, on production day, hundreds of people to make Antiques Roadshow. So I have an enormous amount of help. I have a longtime team who's been with me a long time to make this show. We are reality television, though. And what comes to Antiques Roadshow on that day, I have the delight, my job on that day. I have lots of different jobs. But my job on that day, it's a familiar word to pickers in the world of picking antiques, is I pick, me and two other people do it, pick the objects for television. And that's one of the fun jobs that day. I run around and talk to people like Peter and decide whether or not they have something worth taping. And even after we tape that stuff, I'm the one who watches much of it to decide whether or not it's good enough for air. And I have other staff who helps me do that, too. I have other producers who help me do that. So blessed to be with a terrific team and have appraisers like Peter who know what the heck they're talking about.
So, Peter, that brings us to you then. So what is your background and how did you end up a part of Antiques Roadshow?
Well, if you want to go from the beginning, my mother dragged me around antiquing as a kid when I was a little kid. So I had an appreciation for old things and for antiques. And by the time I was 12, I wanted to collect something. And I started looking at pocket watches. And back then I had a photographic memory. I mean, don't ask me what I had for lunch yesterday. I can't remember. But back then I remembered. And I saw the discrepancies in prices. They were pretty expensive, but you'd see, you know, we'd go to an antique shop or an antique show and, you know, somebody want X amount of dollars. We go to another store and it's the same piece and it was a different price. So we spent our summers in North Carolina riding horses. And anyway, I went to an antique show and this dealer says, I want to get out of the watch business. So he offered me 3 pocket watches for $50. And I went home that night, told my father about it. And he went with me the next day and lent me $50. Bought the 3 watches, showed them to another dealer on the show and sold them for $150 and I paid my father back. And that's got me collecting and my parents didn't give me money so I had to wheel and deal to support my collecting habit. My father did buy me a book. It was book 2 by Roy Ehrhardt on pocket watches, which was great for me. I memorized every movement in it the next 3 days. And 6 years later, I was writing a book with him on wristwatches. The first price guide ever published was published. I started writing when I was 18, published when I was 20. 1984.
Wow.
And became the Bible of the industry. And if you want to go back in time and look at prices, then you'll really cry on what you could have bought stuff for. Daytonas for $350, Milgauss for $350. I mean, stuff was really, by today's standards, my gosh, we had no idea. It was so cheap. So push forward, you know, rather than flipping hamburgers at McDonald's in school, you know, when I went away to college, you know, I started hustling the pawn shops looking for watches. And I would go to my Friday morning economics class and then drive to Tampa International Airport with a briefcase with everything I bought the last 2 weeks, fly to a NAWCC watch show, sell everything and come back. And, you know, that's how I put myself through college was, you know, collecting watches. I started collecting pocket watches when I was 12, started dealing with wristwatches in around 1980-81. 81, I was 17. I didn't collect wristwatches until 1984. They were just going up so fast in value. I said, gosh, the collectors are making more money than me. And I started putting away things. Mm-hmm. And just, it became my vocation. And I'm very blessed that I've traveled the world. Since I'm 18, I've been going to auctions all over the world. And I just, every day I've been blessed. I'm a modern day treasure hunter and loved every minute of what I do. I've been able to just enjoy my passion, my whole life. So it's, you know, very blessed about that. But it's been really a lot of fun. We work hard. Marcia doesn't let us slack off. Okay. We work real hard, but she has a fabulous team. And I remember seeing her on an airplane, one of the first shows I did. And I didn't even know she knew who I was, but I congratulated her on having such a crack team. And she's like, if they weren't good, I would have fired them immediately. So, you know.
But, that's the way to do it, Marshall.
And we've got a tremendous group of friends now. You know, I don't know if you know how watch dealers and collectors are, but, you know, you show them a watch and say, hey, you know, look what I got. You know, like, how much is it? You know, they don't want to give me any information.
All the time.
You know what? We're free with information amongst the dealers. The dealer calls me up on the phone and says, hey, Pete, I'm looking at this. I said, hey, look, you know what? It's worth $20,000, but I'd like to pay $18,000, you know, but we're really honest with each. It's great. And it's like, I can call anybody, you know, whether it's a Tiffany lamp or a piece of furniture. So it's been great. We have this networking of it and really made some great, great friends. And some of them I vacation with now, some of them come and visit with me. I've even had some of the crew come and stay with me in the wintertime. It's been fabulous. I'm going to invite Marcia to come down, but I think she likes the cold weather.
Can people see me sticking my tongue out now, Stephen?
it's an audio medium. And,
yeah. So my next step was to go into the auction business, and now I'm launching my first auction. It's going to be Lux Auctioneers. It's part of my exit strategy to also start selling off. I have a collection of about 3,000 timepieces, so I'm going to start slowly liquidating them.
Some of those watches are watches that you've held on to since you started, since the early 80s?
Since the beginning of time, yes.
Wow.
I was buying 24, Pat referenced 24.99s. We didn't care whether they were series 1, 2, 3, or 4. My first one I paid $12,000 for. It's a series one in pink gold. I still have it. So, you know, I didn't collect Rolex per se, because Rolex was an inferior movement at the time. People said, look at a Patek Philippe, look at a Rolex, you know, you had your choice. So I collected Patek Philippe mainly. But as years went on, I started seeing how valuable Rolexes became and got more and more interested in collecting Rolexes.
Hey, well, I noticed Stephen sort of groaned with envy when you said you paid $12,000 for that watch. What's that watch worth today? Why did that happen?
A pink gold $2,499. You, Peter, you would probably know a current price better than I would.
What is it?
Well, it's probably $2 to $3 million, maybe.
Wow.
For one piece, yeah. So it's. Yeah, I've sold things that are multi-million dollar watches. We didn't know back in the early 80s what was rare and what wasn't rare. I had a platinum Patek Philippe chronograph. And, you know, and unfortunately, God bless his soul, a friend of mine who was a collector, who was a doctor, he was much older than me, maybe he wanted to buy it from me. He said, oh, I had those. That made it sound like it wasn't rare. And I sold it, you know, I think I sold it for $29,000. That's a multi-million dollar watch today, but I would say that I've handled many, many, many pieces. I had so many Rolex moon phases go through my hand when they were $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a piece.
That's wild.
You want to hear something crazy? How about having a first series Milgauss with a lightning bolt hand and taking the hand off and put it on a gold Oyster Perpetual because we thought the hand was cool. You know, let's put that lightning bolt in. it was like a $350, $450 watch. So, you know.
Yeah.
And the hand of that watch is probably worth $10,000, $20,000, you know. So it's total madness. But who knew?
What do you think, if you had to narrow it down to maybe one factor, what do you think is the biggest factor in this change, this huge explosion in prices and knowledge?
Simple supply and demand. You had a lot less collectors originally, okay. And as time goes on, it just kept, you know, building and building. And I got to tell you, I thought Rolexes were overinflated in price the last few years. And then I was at a show in Hong Kong, and I was sitting with a friend of mine, an Italian dealer, had a booth there. And I was watching all these people coming up. And, you know, there is a major collector in every country of the world. And I said, wow, this thing is really big. It's still got room to even go up higher because there are so many collectors now.
I wonder, you know, I have some questions about specific watch stories from Antiques Roadshow. But before we get into that, Marcia, can you give us some context about how an episode of Antiques Roadshow comes together? I think a lot of people are probably wondering, like, how do you get down to the actual episode from everything that you start with?
Well, you know, it starts with our event day. And what happens is we have several thousand people who will come to an event. And that is, by the way, after tens of thousands apply, we ticket so that they can come. And on that day, we cover over 20 categories, including the category of watches. But you can come and bring your furniture, your jewelry, your dolls, or whatever it is. And most of the people who are going to come in that day, they will see one of our about 70 or so experts who are on set that day. And they will learn, basically, that they own something that is a glass vase from 1950, and it's used to hold flowers, and it's worth $50. And then they have something better. And then they don't learn anything that day, you know, at that moment. And what happens is that the appraiser will ask the guest to wait for a producer to come over. And that's what happens every time Peter sees something good. He hopes we think it's as good as he thinks it is, because we don't say yes to everything appraiser pitches to one of us. We don't have as much camera time as we have pitches. So we have to be discerning about what's being pitched to us. Plus, as you notice, we couldn't keep Peter quiet. They are really good salesmen. And so, you know, you just have to stuff a sock in their mouth before they stop pitching. They'll pitch all day long. They're pitching objects. We have a lot to choose from. And we choose what we think is best. Everything we tape, do we use? No, of course not. No producer of any kind of production uses everything they grab. But from what we tape on that day, and we tape multi-camera segments, single camera segments, quick snapshot segments, we will make 3+ episodes of television, mixing that all up. We'll go through all the rushes, watch everything, cut some things, not cut some things. And it's harder than it looks. Frankly, we're cutting shows now virtually. We're able to do that. And we're working together virtually. But it is harder than it looks. It's obvious on things like when a fabulous watch walks in. You know, a fabulous watch walks in, our two-year-old would pick it. But most of what walks in isn't like that. You know, most of what walks in isn't, you know, this is a definite in. So that's what we do. For most of the people who come that day, we provide a public service. We tell them about what they own, and they learn. Very often, they're bringing us inherited things, so they learn a lot about who they are. And that's how we make Antiques Roadshow. We have enough left over from every city that we make an episode called Junk in the Trunk, one of my favorite titles. it's all about touring. And then we make you extra episodes where we have some great updates. And you've seen some of those where we update the values on things like watches that were appraised 15 years ago. And we do, you know, 6-7 vintage programs every year at least. And you've seen some of our watches go up millions of dollars, never mind hundreds of thousands. So we've seen a lot. We don't know what Peter knows. We never will. But we sure know a heck of a lot more than we used to.
is there something about watch stories that you think makes them different from the other categories of things brought on? Is there something that kind of either sets those stories apart or some commonality you find amongst those stories that makes them special?
At least with the watches Roadshow has seen, or the ones we have seen and shared with you, because who can remember all the stuff we've turned down? Most of them are very personal stories. They either bought the watch, or their dad bought the watch, or their mother, whatever. Somebody in the family owned it. It's inherited. From a producer point of view, you know, it's not the biggest object in the world to shoot. Not that anybody cares about that, but, you know, we do. Logistically, it's kind of a small thing. You know, we want to make sure, because people like you and everybody listening to this really care about the details. So we're always driving by the way, just to shoot that thing to the point where you could see those details with us. You know, you could see what Peter's seeing. You could see up as close as a camera can allow it. And so all of it's about putting that together. But for me, the family stories, whether it's a watch, the watch tend to have those ingredients. And they also tend to those who knew enough about provenance mattering and paper mattering. They saved their documentation, the lucky ones. Or probably, and Peter knows this better than me, probably the ones they pitch to us save their documentation. I'm going to guess they see a lot of watches without the documentation that aren't worth pitching. So we have a sieve of what we see versus all those Timexes and other watches that Peter's taken a look at.
With reality television and so much of this stuff is staged, Antiques Roadshow is not like that. And probably most of the public may not realize that, because I know people think, oh, you sent that watch in, you sent that lamp in, you know, it is not staged. And Marcia and her team and the appraisers, we're all looking out for somebody that's going to come in and try to, you know, get on TV with something it is just totally, totally real. And we sift through a lot of stuff. As Marcia was saying, she didn't know how many watches we look at. Everybody has got an old pocket watch in their house, you know, almost everybody. And just between Elgin and Waltham watch companies alone, they made over 80, 90 million million watches. So we see a lot of those all day long waiting, you know, for something really nice that we can pitch.
Oh my goodness. How many of those do you see a day, Peter? It makes me laugh thinking about you looking at all those watches.
That's the rough part, you know.
Funny.
And you don't want to insult anybody, you know, it's their family heirloom, but, you know, it's just the reality is, you know, if they weren't made out of gold or silver, they didn't get melted down, and they've lasted all these years, and everybody still has them. And sometimes we strike out, you know, I could sit at that appraiser's table the whole day and not see one thing worth pitching to the producers saying, hey, this is good television, or this is very interesting, informative.
You know, that's what makes a great find so great. Even though you're seeing it on Roadshow, it's still rare. It's a very rare item that you're seeing. And so the appraisers are as excited as what you see. That's genuine and real because their guy got to see and touch this thing because they're such geeks. They don't care if they don't own it. They just want to touch it. Well, they do care, don't you, Peter? You do care if you don't own it. I say it in jest. But they really are many most like Peter since a young boy, young person, young woman, young girl are crazy for the stuff. And so when they see something that they know they may have once in a lifetime to see it, and they're at a table with other watch appraisers, so it's a matter of who's in line and you get it. So it's even a further luck. Did a great thing come to that city? Did it come to your table? And did it come to you at that table? And it's a really rare thing. So the watches we've seen that are worth six, seven figures, as you guys know, extraordinarily rare objects, and they sift through a lot and can go through a day of seeing things that aren't worth sharing with the nation, shall we say?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's worth getting right into one of the stories that we wanted to talk about today, and that's the Bonanzaville Paul Newman Daytona. You know, I think this is an exceptional, extraordinary watch, and the story and the way you all presented it is fantastic. And I think it's something we get excited about because it makes watches and watch collecting relatable. It's something that, like, I can send to, you know, my friends from college and that I can send to my parents, and, you know, they get it in that way, which I think is something that Roadshow does really well. So I wonder, let's just start at the beginning there. I mean, where did this story start? What's kind of your earliest interaction with this gentleman and his watch?
Well, it started at the appraiser's table. He's got a Rolex box there, and I'm thinking, yeah, probably got a steel and gold Datejust, you know, or something like that inside of it. And then we opened the box, and I could not believe what I was seeing.
I brought in a Rolex watch that I had purchased while I was in the military. I had other watches I wore, and I just put this one into a safety deposit box.
This particular model is referred to as an Oyster Cosmograph. They're also referred to as Daytonas.
I could not believe what I was seeing. You know, I thought he had like maybe a two-tone Datejust Rolex in there or something. I open up this box, and here I'm staring at, you know, really could be called the Holy Grail there, you know, of Antiques Roadshow finds. And you need a major poker face because, I mean, you want to just yell out, wow, but you can't, you know? You just got to. And at that point, you know, we're sort of like detectives in a way. We need to vet this person and see, you know, did Steven send his friend over to, you know, to mess with us, you know? So, you know, we start asking questions, you know? What can you tell me about? How did you get it? A lot of questions, and then I realized this is the real deal. He's had it. He's the original owner.
What happens is that Peter is finishing up. He's decided to pitch the watch to me. Peter pitches me the watch, and he tells me, you know, this. He tells me what you're going to hear on air. He tells me what this thing is worth. And I go over to interview the guest. He knew he had something good. He wouldn't tell me what the dollar amount was, but my sense is that he was thinking somewhere around 75 grand. You know, Peter, do you agree with that? Maybe that was where he was thinking in his mind, 50, 100, maybe, you know, but nothing like what Peter was going to tell him. He did not have a clue. This I can attest to. He knew it was good, but that good, no way. Didn't know.
A watch like this at auction is worth about $400,000. You okay?
I didn't think he'd fall down. I'm so glad he did. But it's every producer's dream, really.
Don't fall. I'm not done yet. I said a watch like yours because of the condition of it. Your watch at auction today, $500,000 to $700,000.
You're good.
No, I'm very serious.
Oh, it's an
absolute. Peter, you mentioned having to keep a poker face, right? And so the person clearly knows that it's interesting because you've brought a producer over, but how do you sort of like ease them into the idea that like maybe it's something really special?
I don't ease them into it. I don't let on any knowledge at all to them. I just ask them, you know, you mind if we do the appraisal on camera? And most people say yes, but there are people, Marsh will tell you, they don't want to be filmed. Mm-hmm. I had a lady one time who was from a very prominent American family, and she says, I can't, I'm a such and such. You know, so what, you can't do anything about it, you know? But, that's it. I don't say anything. Put it away. We don't want anybody else to see it, right? Because you come walking by and go, let me see that. You know, so, you know, it's put away. And they wait. And the next time we're talking is when we're on set. We've got everything set up there. And then you saw the appraisal. I just start talking about it. And I start telling them what they have. And I, you know, ask them about, you know, how they got it and, you know, a little bit of history about it. And we don't tell them anything. So, and as people know, they watch Antiques Roadshow. Some things are not valuable. Sometimes they find out something's not real, you know, but we don't say anything until we get them in front of that camera. Because it is a TV show and Marsha wants the reaction.
I will tell them when we have our coaching meeting the day before we tape, don't be a leaky faucet. Because you get so excited when you see something, do not tip off the guest with your uncontained enthusiasm, because we don't want them to learn before the taping. We make an honest show. We're on PBS. Our reputation is everything. When you see it being taped, that is the first time the guest is learning the info. We didn't rehearse it earlier. Even if we have to retake something, we use the first real reaction. The integrity of what you're seeing is everything you imagine PBS should be doing, and we are, yeah.
That's great. So for this Paul Newman find, I mean, Peter, you referred to it as sort of the Holy Grail. I mean, for both of you, does this stand out as kind of the pinnacle watch moment on Antiques Roadshow, or is there another that you think is maybe close?
This is the pinnacle watch moment from a producer's point of view because he fell down. I mean, it's worth an enormous amount of money. We have watches that have updated to more value, but didn't tape at that value. So that's a difference.
Okay.
And so that has the record like that. But if somebody could come to Roadshow and fall down or do something like that once every season, as a producer, I am just gaga about it. Peter, if you have another find like that, you'll be a lucky man.
Well, I really feel fortunate to say that I feel I have the trifecta, because I got a crier. I had somebody stop breathing and I had somebody fall down. So, you know, I feel really content.
You're just knocking them down here with watch knowledge.
That's true. I knocked out a person without even laying a hand on them.
Oof. Do you ever have people after you give them these valuations say like, okay, now what? Like, what do I do with this thing? Like, okay, I have this watch that's worth close to $1 million. How do I get that $1 million? Like, what do I do with this?
Yes. I mean, I think all the appraisers, you know, our information is on the PBS website, and we're in the information booklet that is passed out to everybody, our contact information. So I do get contacted after events, sometimes much later. Sometimes people think a long time, and but not everybody, but we get people to contact us and say, could you assist us in selling it? Or I'd like to get an updated appraisal. Some people want to keep the things and they ask about restoring them, insuring them.
I will say this, and we know this from as producers of the show, very rarely do people part with their objects no matter what we value them for. They keep them. They insure them. They hand them down to their children. They do whatever, they protect them. They may now realize they have to protect them in some other way if they have extraordinary value. But most of what you've seen on Roadshow, including this watch to this point, has not seen the market. And that is true for most everything we see.
There have been a couple other, I would say, like big watch moments. You know, there's the 6542 GMT. That was recorded, I believe, in 2016. There was a Tiffany dial GMT. Can you maybe walk us through that 6542 GMT story? That's another one that I know our audience really kind of loves.
I love that one too, because the reaction of the gentleman was also just so wonderful. And, you know, I love it when I can appraise something and it can be life-changing for a person with the evaluation. I know you're asking about the GMT. I'm just going to step back for a second. The gentleman that owned the Daytona, I mean, you know, I asked him what he did after the war. He was a welder. So, you know, I don't know what his savings was. I mean, I'm sure he, you know, whatever they are, obviously that watch could have just doubled at his retirement. So, you know, it's just wonderful to get great news. On the day that we looked at the 6542, the gentleman came up to the table and he brought two watches. Both of them he bought at the PX when he was in Germany. And as you know, you guys seen the video, you know the story. It's a great story. He really was totally clueless that the watch had any value at all. I love the reaction. Great, sincere reaction. At the very end, our mics were hot. And, you know, after he was speechless, as he said, and he really looked like he stopped breathing. I had a lot of friends when they watched that. They were all calling me going, what are you trying to kill the guy? You know, he stopped breathing. But he was totally speechless. And, you know, here's a gentleman late stage in life, and he finds out that his watch is worth a lot of money. And as he reacted at the very end, he did say, you know, I would have been happy if you told me $1,500. And so it was just fantastic.
It's interesting, and, because these people, when they come to you, these objects already have tremendous value to them, even if it's emotional value, if it's not financial value. So it must be an interesting experience for them to realize that there's this whole sort of secondary store of value. It's sentimental, but like other people also value this thing. It must be kind of an interesting like moment of reckoning.
As Marcia said earlier, a lot of these people don't part with these things because they can't let go of those emotional feelings. And so not a lot of these things do come on the market, even though you would think they do. And the stories are amazing. I mean, we hear a lot of stories. I mean, you know, even things that are not worth a lot of money. I've had people bring me up a $20 watch, a $50 watch, but the stories, you know, it means so much to them. It belonged to somebody in their life that was just very important to them. And that's the interesting thing about watches. I think most of the watches were not acquired later on. They really are personal objects that have either been passed down in the family or were acquired by the owner. Where other things, you get a lot of things where people, they went to a yard sale, they saw a nice painting, you know, they said, wow, you know, I liked it and I bought it. I didn't know it was worth a lot of money but at the time. But watches tend to be really personal. So there's that connection.
Are there any other anecdotes that stand out to you, whether it's from watches that made the show, watches that, you know, you encountered that weren't quite right for TV, but the story has stuck with you over the years?
Yes, I've seen some fabulous stuff that for one reason or another could not be aired. You know, one of them was this lady. We were in Newport, Rhode Island, and saw a lot of wonderful things come in, a lot of wonderful things. The watch and jewelry table was combined, and we saw a lot of nice things come in. One of them, I can't say the family name, but one of the big robber baron families of this country, a lady was a descendant, and you know, I wanted to put her on air, and she said, "Oh no, I can't do that." She didn't want to be seen. It's a shame. We've seen things that are wonderful, but not everybody wants to be filmed. And part of the reason also I've noticed is sometimes we see things and everybody, when somebody passed away in their family, everybody got to pick something. Well, you know, one of those four or five people got lucky and got the really rare thing. And then if they get on air, their siblings are like, hey, you owe me money. I want my share of it. You know, it's not fair that, you know, you got the $100,000 piece and I got the $500 piece, you know, but at the time maybe it was all worth $500, you know.
No, that is the downside of being on the road show. If you're the family member thing is like, suddenly you see, oh, but I own this with my sister. How do we split it in two? And so that's the only time this great financial news, you see this, oh, moment. And then this, oh, how do I deal with that? but they figure it out. But yeah, that's the little cloud in their sunny world.
Do you ever have people who are all excited to be filmed, and then once they get the news, whether it's positive or negative, start having second thoughts and come to you and say, I'm not quite so sure?
Absolutely.
Or are people pretty, yeah?
So we have learned over the years, and you'll learn this if you now come to Roadshow, you'll know why we do it. When you come, you have to sign a materials and a person release. That's, you know, we have lawyers who make us have everybody sign a release. It basically tells us we can use that footage however we want, online, on broadcast, on anything. We make sure you sign it before you tape, because you're not going to get to change your mind after you tape and tell us that you don't want us to use it, because that happens. I've had a woman who, it's a funny story about a piece of jewelry that she was convinced we swapped out while I took it over to show to another jeweler, swapped the rubies out with the ones I had just like it in my pocket, and, you know, really, it didn't have the, okay, whatever. Or I had someone call me this season about an object that we aired recently that was very valuable jewelry, who after we taped it, she did not want it to air. So they get regret. We talked about it, and I promised her, as we've promised all our guests, and this is true for everyone, and it's true even for those of our appraisers, that we will keep her identity a secret. That the only ones who will know who she is are people who know her. We won't tell our appraisers your last name. We won't tell anyone. Unless you have special access to our database at Roadshow, we won't let anybody find you. And so I convinced her to let us air her pricey jewelry. But I think people get nervous afterwards that they could be victims or some other, or family, in particular, family. Why did you get those and I didn't? Well, we haven't heard of any wars yet on it.
Perfect. Yeah. Good. Keeping the peace.
The peace is in the family still. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if for either one of you, do you have any sort of dream finds, you know, whether it's watches or otherwise, like something that every time you host an event, you just say, this is the thing I hope comes through the door today?
Well, the Peter has a watch answer for that. For me, it's not the thing, it's the story. Because for me, ultimately, story is king. And so for me, what I hope happens is that something really rare and extraordinary comes in that allows us to be the first documenter, i.e. the discoverer of some new piece of information that makes every scholar in the nation go gaga, and it's worth a ton of money. And then after the guest learns that, they fall down and faint, absolutely. Whatever the object is, I'm good with it. But all those ingredients are perfect for me.
That's a hell of an episode of TV right there.
Isn't it? I mean, can you just see it now? But the experts, they all have the thing, and I bet you Peter has the thing or two that he wants.
As a collector and a dealer, yes, I love to see fabulous things. But I got to tell you, I think I like more seeing that I can change somebody's life by telling them what they have. I really do. If you ask me, what am I proudest most about what I've done on Roadshow is that I've gotten these sincere reactions out of people where maybe I've changed their life. Maybe they were, who knows? I mean, you know, we all can be down on our luck, finances, whatever, and all of a sudden find out that everything has been fixed. I did a Patek Philippe pocket watch that the man thought was worth about $1,000 for the gold bag. He's the crier, you know, and if you go on the website, you'll see that appraisal. But he started crying, and it, you know, maybe it was life-changing for him. I didn't ask him why he cried, but it was a life-changing experience. I mean, you know, maybe you needed $30,000 or $50,000, and boom, you just won the lottery. And that's basically what happens when you find out that, you know, you bought something for $350 and it's worth maybe $700,000 to $1 million today or whatever. You know, it's a lottery ticket. And I really like that more than I don't want to say I've seen it all, because I haven't seen it all, but I'm really blessed that I've traveled the world since I'm 18. I went to every major auction in the world, every museum, and I've had so many fine things pass through my hands. And I've acquired a lot of fine things. So I like the experience of seeing changing somebody's life by telling them something that they didn't know, that they did not know that all along they've had sitting in that vault or sitting in that drawer under the socks, wherever they kept it, buried in the backyard, that, you know, there's the answer, you know, to their retirement, pay their mortgage off, send their kids to college, whatever it is. And that is, I truly love that experience. And it's, you can't get that anywhere else, but to change somebody's life and give them good news.
That's fantastic. I wonder, are there any, and I'm sure you can only say a little bit, but are there any yet unaired watch stories kind of in the can that we have to look forward to in future episodes?
Unaired? No, because Marcia, the good ones get aired.
All the films in it. So she knows what she has and what she hasn't aired and what she might air in the future.
The good ones, we air them. But what we are, and we're making them now, we're producing them now, are vintage episodes where we update prices. And that's where you learn some extraordinary things, well, we learn some extraordinary things, because along the way, as we update values like that, we can learn things that inform the value. And so, yeah, we'll have some good watch updates coming for you. Absolutely.
Great.
Yeah.
Perfect. We'll make sure to link people to that so that everybody can check it out. Thank you both so much for joining us for this. This is great, and we'll have to have you back and keep this conversation going, because I know, like I said, these stories are, they're watch stories, but they're human stories. They're stories about people's lives. They're stories about what, you know, people connect with, what brings people together, and it's really sort of the same ethos that ultimately this show is about. And you know, we're always happy to see these stories from you guys. It's really fantastic.
Well, thank you for sharing the stories and for helping to amplify them, because this is a feel-good time. This is a good time for Antiques Roadshow, and to help share our stories, we're really grateful. Thank you. Plus, I really like seeing your bed. You know what I like about these virtual sessions is that I know you are in your bedroom, and there's your bed, and that Peter's in his fancy office with all kinds of geeky things around him, and when else could we learn this about each other?
We're all doing our best. Our homes are now studios and offices and rec centers and whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But awesome. Thank you both so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anytime, Stephen.
And up next, we get an update on the state of the watch industry from our own Joe Thompson. Hey, Joe. Thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to be here, Stephen.
I haven't talked to you in, what, probably like 45 minutes, an hour maybe?
Just about. That's it.
Yeah. I feel like I need to put you on my like favorites list on my phone speed dial. I feel like I dial you more than I dial like my mom or anybody else at this point.
Yeah, but this time it's on Hodinkee Radio. That's a big change.
That's true.
That's a big change for me.
This is a public conversation, not behind the scenes machinations. I wanted to have you on the show, you know, because there's been a whole lot going on, obviously, in the watch world and in the broader world at large. But I know you've been hard at work kind of trying to parse through all the various sources of data and all of the sort of like firsthand accounts of what is happening in the watch world right now in light of coronavirus, in light of other things. And then, you know, also what all of this means for Baselworld. So I figure we'll talk about both things if that works for you, kind of the big picture, and then zoom in a little bit onto Baselworld. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, sure. As you wish.
Perfect. So yeah, I guess we'll start at like the most macro level. I mean, if you had to give an assessment of sort of like where the watch industry is in 2020, what's it looking like?
Well, I guess the first point I would make is that right now, the watch industry is experiencing a historic downturn. We all know why. What we know is that the first quarter was bad. And the second quarter will be worse. The second quarter will be brutal. And the thing to say, this is reporting coming in the middle of the second quarter.
Right.
So this is reporting, you know, as the earthquake is happening. This is in the middle of the tsunami hitting. so that I don't have a heck of a lot of data. Some people are doing their best to make forecasts for a financial analyst, for example, whose job it is to do that. And I guess the one thing I just want to sort of start by saying is that we are aware that the pandemic is just doing horrible things, you know, to the world. And this is a global pandemic, which is a global tragedy. The global watch industry is not nearly as hard hit as other industries, the airlines, the retail, entertainment, hospitality, restaurants, all of that. But it is the industry that we do focus on. And so the first thing, so that what's happening now is that we are looking, as I say, at a historic downturn. We can focus on the Swiss industry. That's what we deal with mostly. The only available data that we actually have right now would be export data from Switzerland for the first quarter.
Okay.
And for January, I mean, actually the year ironically got off to a very good start. Right. Swiss exports were up in value 9.4% in January, which is when, of course, the word reaches the public about the trouble in China. In February, Swiss watch exports dropped to 9.2%. But China, the historically the number three market, drops to number nine. Oof. They get very, very heavily. And then in March, Swiss watch exports drop another 22%. And that's the latest data that we have. Now, the thing about that is that for the other big markets in the world, Europe and the United States, most of the first quarter captured very little of the lockdowns that would occur. I mean, we're talking about most of the of those 12 weeks in Q1, only two would be reflecting the lockdown. So that what we're looking at now is something really much worse. There are forecasts for the second quarter. Bank Vontobel, for example, in Zurich, is predicting that value will be down 40% in value for the second quarter.
Wow.
But we do. And they are, just go on to the whole full year, they are also predicting that this year will be one of the worst, if not the worst, in Swiss watch history, certainly in Swiss watch modern history. And we'll get to that in a minute. But we do know anecdotally that, for example, let's take China. The lockdown in China, which is the engine of growth for the Swiss watch industry, was terrible. Nick Hayek told a Swiss newspaper, we are massively hit by the temporary closing of hundreds of stores. This was in the February-March period. And for the Swatch Group, for example, that just is China and Greater China and Chinese who travel to the United States and to Europe are just a huge portion of their sales. And so that has been shut down.
Yeah, that's a part that I think is interesting and worth kind of explaining to people who may not realize that, but that, you know, sales, when we talk about China being a strong market, it's not just sales happening in China. It's the newly wealthy in China who are traveling and making purchases outside of China. I mean, I've heard numbers, you know, anywhere, I guess this was a couple of years ago, but somebody told me at one point, somebody relatively reliable, that 50% of the watch sales in New York City happened to Chinese tourists. And like, that number doesn't sound unplausible to me. Maybe it's 1 in 3, but you know, it's a huge impact if you don't have Chinese tourists purchasing watches in New York, in Los Angeles, in Paris, in London, in Geneva. That could be a huge impact, right?
Absolutely. And as we look ahead, and we'll get to that in a bit, even as some people are optimistic about, let's say, the second half of this year. I mean, that's sort of a debate at this point in the industry about what the second half will look like. Everybody concedes the first half is going to be horrible. But in predicting the second half, one needs to remember that the Chinese are most likely not going to be traveling. I mean, that's the point. We don't know anything about the second half. It's all uncertain, as they say. But the loss of that business in European markets and the American market will sting. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Chinese were buying more at home anyway. The Chinese government wanted that. And so, will China be able to resume its role as the economic engine for Swiss watch seals? We'll just have to see. The impact of all this on the industry in Switzerland has been pretty severe. We've covered it on Hodinkee to some extent, but what we know, of course, is that that factories have shut down. Many factories. I mean, it's Rolex, Patek Philippe, AP, Hublot, TAG. Many factories have shut down. New product launches have been either abandoned by some companies, like who can afford to, I have to say, that would be Rolex and Patek Philippe. But other companies are finding it hard to launch new products because the venues in which you would do that, they've been postponed because of the coronavirus epidemic. We'll get to the Baselworld situation later. Watches and Wonders is a virtual show.
Do you have a sense, Joe? Do you have a sense in terms of production, right? I mean, I know earlier today news broke. We're recording this a couple days before people hear it, but news broke today that Rolex is in the process of reopening its manufacturing. But from some of the watchmakers I've spoken to, watchmaking companies, not individual watchmakers. There are a few that have already opened, Ulysse Nardin, Gerard Perregaux. I know Piaget is making right now. But what I've heard is that from various sources, that the sort of tight quarters of watch manufacturing presents a problem for getting back to scale. That even if the manufacturers are opening, you can no longer have, 10 people lined up on benches next to and across from one another. Everybody has to be 6 feet apart. Everybody has to have ample room to move about and to get in. You can only have, one or two people in a clean facility at a time. So these companies that already, especially the more popular ones, are already having problems delivering necessary quantity to meet demand, are now, even if they're producing, they're not going to be able to produce at 100% capacity because they may only be able to fit 25% or 30% of their watchmakers in their facilities at any one time. Have you heard similar things? Do you have any sense of
well,
that?
No. Yes, I have heard that even in Rolex's case, they've said that they're not going to be able to bring everybody back because they are not equipped for social distancing, and so that it will take a while before they tool up and all of them tool up. But the issue is, I mean, what demand? This is the problem. I mean, you don't want to be tooling up. The inventories are already building, in shops that are closed. I mean, this is the serious problem. I mean, that's what Hayek's talking about. I mean, he's massively hit because all the stores in China were closed, for 7 weeks or whatever it is.
Sure.
And so the situation, and also the situation with regard to the factories, is that there are 40,000 people out of a total workforce of about 57,000 that are now on short time in Switzerland, because people have just ramped down production as a result of the lockdown and shutdown. When these people come back to work, remains to be seen whether all those jobs will be there in the second half. Also remains to be seen. There are also issues with regard to in the Swiss watch region, as you know, Stephen, and many know, it's the Jura region, which is the border with France. Many of the people who work in the factories in Geneva, in the Vallée des Joux, in La Chaux-de-Fonds, commute from France. Well, the border is shut. And so there are complications there with regard to the industry shutting down. It's not just Switzerland. The Movado Group, based here in Paramus, New Jersey, they put on furlough 850 of their workforce, starting on April 6th. Ephraim Grinberg announced that as long as there was, Ephraim Grinberg, who was the CEO of the Movado Group, announced that he would take no salary for as long as the furlough period lasted. And the salaried executives of the group are on have taken 15-25% cuts in the salary. And it's just, this is just sort of the anecdotal examples of the impact that it's had on the industry. As I mentioned, it's not just the shutdown and the is not just production. It's also distribution into the markets that are now locked down. And one little sort of moment in terms of how unusual all of this is came at the end of March when on the FH website. The FH is the Federation of the Swiss Watch Industry. It's the association of all of the watch companies and brands. And the CEO, the president, as they call him, is a very nice man. I've known him for years and years, named Jean-Daniel Pache. And I'm covering this, as I've mentioned many times, more than 40 years, and I've never seen anything like this statement that he put on fhs.swiss, which is their website. I'll just read the first paragraph of it. This was there on March 26th. Who would have thought it? Who could have imagined just a few months ago, at the end of 2019, when we found out something was in the making, in quotes, in China, that Switzerland would be facing a wave of such magnitude today? Remember SARS in 2003 when we felt as if we had seen it all, with Asian exhibitors being banned from opening our booths at Baselworld? Yet it was nothing compared to what is happening today. And life is indeed proving stranger than fiction. What a lesson in humility when confronted with the natural events that are beyond our grasp. And then he goes on to say, express, of course, the concern for everyone who was affected by this human, social, and economic tragedy, as he puts it. And then he talks about the watchmaking companies which are deeply affected in terms of their operation or whose very existence is in jeopardy. And that is true. We can get to that a little bit. There will be a shakeout. Not everybody is going to make it. That is the forecast. That is the prediction.
Who is at the highest risk? Not companies in particular, but what sort of profile of watch company is the company most at risk here?
Just the smaller brands that are undercapitalized. There are just literally hundreds of small brands, regional brands. I mean, the one brand that we know of that declared bankruptcy that had some brand recognition internationally was Romain Jerome.
Yeah.
And they went down in March. And so others, we don't know. The estimate I'm hearing is 30. I've heard as high as 60. And we just have to see. As I say, in the middle of this, we don't know.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure.
Go ahead. I want to make sure we get into the Baselworld dynamics too. I think, as we talk about different size brands and who's reacting different ways, I think Baselworld might provide a sort of like microcosm potentially. Does that work for you?
Sure. You want to go there now?
Yeah, I think it's worth diving into that. I think people will find it pretty interesting, and I think in our chats, I have found it immensely interesting. So, I mean, essentially, if I understand it correctly, the timeline of this is Baselworld was going ahead as planned. No Swatch Group, no Breitling. Sort of what we expected for this year. Everything was fine. Then coronavirus hit. And sort of on the late side of things, it was late March when Baselworld finally said they phrased it as a postponement it really is if we're calling a spade here, it's a cancellation. They postponed it in scare quotes to January 2021. So, right. You know, 8 or 9 months. And that happened. And then just a few weeks later, sort of out of nowhere, you know, we saw this group of five brands kind of lead a charge out of Baselworld, including Rolex, Tudor, Patek, and then it was Chopard and Chanel as well. And from there, essentially, Baselworld looked like it was withering on the vine, and we just received confirmation earlier this week that it is, in fact, at least in its current incarnation, dead. Like, that is now official. There will not be a show called Baselworld that takes place in Basel with watch brands in January 2021. The organizers, MCH, the group that puts the show on, is saying that they might do something else. They might do it in a different location. It'll probably be smaller, but they're not committing to anything. Is that a pretty reasonable grasp of the timeline? You know this much better than
yes,
I do.
Yes. The only thing it actually was the end of February.
Okay.
Not a big deal, but that and it was because the Swiss Federal Council made what amounts to a declaration of emergency for the country and began the lockdown. Absolutely. Yes, the state of play right now with regard to the whole Baselworld story is this. Point one would be that, as you put it, Baselworld is dead. And the MCH group, the large exhibition company that owns it, realizes that Baselworld, as being held in Basel, is finished. Point two is the Swiss watch show scene has shifted to Geneva. And though the king of the watch shows is dead, there is no new king. And so we have to wait and see what is going to happen down in Geneva next April, April 2021. Point three would be that MCH, however, still is in the game. They know they can't put anything on in Basel, but they are exploring new locations and new formats. So they're still wanting to try and make it go because they have clients. There are in winners and losers here. Some of the losers are the small and medium sized companies that did need Baselworld in order to make sales and meet customers. They are not able to sponsor their own summits globally or go around the world. They need people to come to one location where they exhibit. And then the fourth thing is sort of the postmortem on Baselworld. It's sort of shocking. I mean, what killed this 103-year-old show that had survived World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, and the Quartz Crisis? And we can talk a little bit about that if you like. I mean, there are immediate causes and remote causes. I mean, the fatal blow came when they lost the confidence of Rolex. And the really intriguing question is what happened there? As of 1 year ago, Rolex was still robustly expressing support for Baselworld. You may recall that when George Kern announced that Breitling, George Kern, the CEO of Breitling, announced that they were pulling out of Baselworld. Rolex allowed Baselworld to announce that it was going to build a brand new booth for Tudor, and it was going to build another Rolex booth, once a bigger, better Rolex booth. Now, they built the booth that is in Baselworld in 2013 at a cost of 30 million Swiss francs. So, you know, just do the math as to what they were going to invest in Baselworld. This was last April this occurred. Something happened in recent months and to lead to this situation whereby Rolex is the ringleader in organizing the departure of the five brands that left Baselworld just in recent weeks. And once Rolex and Patek leave, That's the most powerful Swiss watch company and the most prestigious Swiss watch company. When they team up to leave and make statements talking about how difficult it was with Basel, it's over. So who lost Rolex is a sort of a parlor game that is now going on in Switzerland as to what happened there. But this is of course coming as a consequence of the pandemic. There's no doubt about that. That's a that the answer to the immediate cause was that the pandemic leads to the declaration of a lockdown in Switzerland, which leads to Baselworld not being able to hold a show in 2020. It leads to it postponing it to January of 2021. And then the trouble starts because there is friction over one, most importantly, the date of January 2021. And then once the show and then refunds for the canceled 2020 show. So that's the immediate cause. One factor in all of this, strangely enough, is geography.
Right.
It is worth noting that of the five brands that left, three of them are based in Geneva. Rolex, right. Patek Philippe, and Chopard are based in Geneva. And so at a certain point, it seems those, Jean-Frédéric Dufour, the CEO of Rolex, Terry Stern, the CEO of Patek Philippe, decided, and then they, I'm told, presented the option to call Friedrich Schäuble, the CEO of Chopard, that, listen, why don't we just go down to, you know, let's have this show here. Let's have it in our own hometown, in our own home canton. And so this was people tell me, a factor in this decision once the frustration had gotten so high with Baselworld management, even the current management.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me too that, you know, not just the geographic difference, but the sort of second order effect of that. And this is obviously now purely in the realm of speculation, but for those of us who travel to Switzerland frequently, you know, they're really, Switzerland is not a homogenous place as some people might assume it would be. It's in fact extremely, you know, within a certain set of boundaries, it's relatively diverse. And, you know, there are multiple languages spoken, depending on the region, tells you which language that might be. You know, the sorts of parts of Europe where people are from in those regions where people settled there from vary. And it's worth noting that not only is Basel not in the canton of Geneva, it is in German-speaking Switzerland in the north, whereas Geneva is in French-speaking Switzerland in the south. And sort of culturally, these divisions are much more pronounced than you might assume. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the French-speaking contingent of the industry, which is traditionally sort of the heart of watchmaking, it's the Vallée du Jou, it's Geneva, sort of, you know, didn't love the idea that the perceived heart of watchmaking was a town in German Switzerland that basically doesn't make watches.
No, absolutely. And it's interesting. I mean, the one of the big losers, obviously, and the winners and losers of the Basel drama is the city of Basel itself. It is estimated, right, that in the good years, and that's not long ago, I'm talking 2014, literally 1 billion Swiss francs went into the coffers of Basel City and Basel State, Baselstadt as they call it. Because of just that 2-week period when for the 8-day show and then a bit of setup and a bit of takedown, but it was 1 billion Swiss francs that that went into the city. And Geneva is already, I mean, there was a state councilor of Geneva who had already calculated this is going to bring 100 million Swiss francs to 120 million Swiss francs to this show that will be at the Palexpo next year, or this actually series of shows. We can talk about that if we want, about what actually is going to happen there. because it is not just one show. But SIHH, forgive me, now called Watches and Wonders, brings in about $100 million. So that there's the stakes are high here in terms of where you have these. And so the big loser there is in Basel was the local hospitality industry. Now, yeah, many would say they deserve it. They really did bring this on themselves, and they had nobody but themselves to blame. Yeah. But they are going to they're going to pay dearly for this.
I mean, having tried to book hotels and Airbnbs for our team for, you know, the better part of a decade now, and having had to put a credit card down at many a restaurant in Basel, Switzerland. And in fact, once having been handed the non-Basel fare version of a menu and being told at the end that actually all of the prices were wrong, I can say, like, the hospitality industry there, I think, really did kind of bring it on themselves. They did not do much to make the city easy and accessible. They really did everything to kind of try to wring every dollar they could out of folks, which, you know, fair enough. But I think I agree with you in the sense that hospitality industry brought it on itself, and didn't some watchmakers even cite that as one of the reasons for leaving, that it was difficult on them and their teams, and also didn't make a particularly hospitable environment for their retailers and the press they were trying to entertain?
Well, people have been complaining about it for years. And in fact, I know this from Basel World executives themselves. For years, they were, especially the new management. Since the new management came in, it was perfectly clear that something had to change there. But they found the Basel World hospitality industry to be very reluctant to change. They found them to be really, really stubborn. They worried. Mm-hmm. I know that at one point, Mr. Loris Melikoff, who's the head of the show, kind of just threatened to move the show himself out of Basel because it was hurting the Basel World brand. Let me say a little bit about what they're trying to do, just to update this thing. What MCH is exploring is perhaps going to have a show that would accommodate the small and medium-sized watch companies. And they might be able to have it, let's say, for example, in Lausanne. Lausanne is about 30 miles from Geneva. It's an easy drive by car or van. It's an even easier train trip right from the airport at Palexpo, which is at the airport. So that would be one option that they may be able to keep a watch show going. It obviously would not be called Basel World. And there are, or they're looking at also regional shows. Could be the U.S., could be Abu Dhabi, could be China. They're also looking at the trying to perhaps do something digital, new formats that they were intending to develop for Basel World. So this isn't easy. I mean, none of these shows are easy. There's no guarantee for any of these shows that are down there now. I mean, the lay of the land right now at Palexpo is you will have Watches and Wonders, which is its own show. This year was scheduled to have 30 exhibitors. And then affiliated with that, which is what they are using, is the show of the Rolexit show when the five brands, Rolex, Patek, Philippe.
I like that Rolexit. I'm into that.
Well, to me, that's the saga. I mean, this is how, when Rolex led the withdrawal of those brands out of Basel, and then LVMH. We know the four LVMH brands. A Tag, Hublot, Zenith, and Bulgari, they are going to be down there in some capacity. And it's even conceivable, and I got this from you, Stephen, that Palexpo is a big place.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Also conceivable that MCH might be able to rent space in there. And so that Geneva, which is actually a bigger city than Basel, the Switzerland's largest city is Zurich. The second largest is Geneva. And Basel is actually third. But we'll have to see what happens. You do have this tremendous fragmentation. We don't know what is going to happen with the Swatch Group. and with all of the other brands that had scheduled things this year, Grand Seiko and others that had to, well, Breitling, for example, that wants to have its own summits. We'll just have to see what happens in next year for all of this. Yeah, that has been a drama. The one thing I would say that it's almost, I don't even know how to put this, but the lesson I learned out of this is that I need to talk to more taxi drivers. And what I have to tip my hat to the taxi drivers of Basel who, as you know, Stephen, and the audience probably does not, but that in 2 years ago, I did a story that was titled Basel World Fights for Its Life. And in the lead, I report shocking news that was given to me by a Swiss watch CEO. And the shocking news was that there would be one more Basel World in 2019, and then the show would die. And he had impeccable sources for this. And the sources were the Basel taxi drivers. And he was needling me. And he was saying to me, I mean, I can't take credit for any of this. I didn't predict this. He was needling me. He said, hey, they're better than, you know, who needs you? They're better than the journalists. And the taxi drivers were right. It was one more show, and then it folded. It was one and done, as I put it in the story. So here's to those guys.
Yeah, seriously. So Joe, if we're going to look forward a little bit, I know you can't see the future here, but where do you think this is going? Like, what do you think the future of the industry and of the shows look like? Like, what are we going to think in 6 months, let's say?
Yeah, that's the question, Stephen. And the first thing to say is that absolutely nobody knows. It was interesting. George Kern, for example, told the Financial Times that he hasn't even done a budget. He's just abandoned his budget. He says it doesn't make sense.
Right.
Most of the industry people are not making forecasts for the second half. The public companies, for example, Movado, Fossil, Seiko, Citizen, they're just normally they give guidance, you know, for the next quarter, et cetera. They're not even bothering. They're just saying it's just impossible to know. We do have some forecasts. This Bank Vontobel study, they're saying for the year that it would be down 25%. It's worth noting that would be, according to them, the single worst year for the past 50 years in terms of single year drops. So that even during the quartz crisis, the worst year was down 15% in terms of Swiss watch exports. And even the Great Recession of 2009, it was down 22%. They think this year will be worse. This is in line with the luxury good industry forecasts, and watts, certainly Swiss watches are part of that. Those are running minus 25, minus 35%, a couple of the forecasts that I've seen. The Swiss watch industry CEOs are hesitant to predict. Some are saying, well, look, there's going to be pent-up demand. There's going to be a recovery in China. Because, you know, Wuhan has come out of the lockdown, et cetera, and Shanghai, and the stores are opening again. Fair enough, that's a debate right now. Because the other factor is that, yes, Chinese will not be traveling, as we mentioned. And I think there's really a question as to, there's also the question as to online shopping. Yes, that's picked up, no doubt about it, in this pandemic. But for the Swiss watch industry generally, that's not much of an answer. Online shopping represents, I've seen estimates from 2% to a maximum of 5% of the total Swiss watch sales. The Swiss industry has been reluctant to embrace e-commerce, and they're going to pay for it this year. Those who have will weather the storm better, but that's not going to be the solution to the second half of this year. And then the question, I think, is whether or not people want to buy. Let's take the U.S. market, which sort of has been on a roll. We are now number one. We've been number one since last August. We will stay number one. Hong Kong has no hope of recovering this year. But the question is, you know, what's going to happen now? Even sure, there's pent-up demand. But there are two factors. There's the fear factor. will people return to the stores when they do open? You know, when our lockdowns, we're just starting to open up here in the not what is now the number one watch market in the world. And then there's the feel good factor. I mean, even if people can afford to buy a luxury watch, will they want to do it now? You know, at a time when 150,000 people died in the United States, whatever that figure is going to be by the end of the year, and, you know, 400,000 died globally. And when there are depression era unemployment and depression era like food lines, do you really want to buy something then? So this is what the debate is. Literally, obviously, nobody knows. A lot depends on how quickly it takes to open up. A lot depends on whether or not there's a second wave of the virus and when it is we get a vaccine, which is certainly not expected to be this year. So that's what, and then for Switzerland, yeah, I mean, they're saying 4,000 jobs were lost in the Great Recession. That'll certainly be that many this year. And then we'll see how many watch firms go out. But unfortunately, it's a grim picture for 2020. And, you know, you just hope that, and I'll maybe just end with this. The Great Recession ended with a V-shaped recovery. It was way, way down, down 22% in 2009, up 22% in 2010. Bank Van Tobel kind of used that as its model. It's predicting a 15% recovery in 2021. And that's getting way out. Nobody knows. But the difference between the Great Recession and now is that China was just growing and the world wasn't in a government-induced lockdown. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Okay.
So that's, wish I had better news.
No, I mean, it's realistic news. It's no good news for now, but potential for good news later, maybe. I think we'll that's maybe the optimistic read, but yeah, we'll keep checking in with you. I'm going to drag you back on the show from time to time so that we can keep following up on this. I mean, like you say, it's the macro picture is far from sharp a couple months out. And, you know, there's still plenty of time for things to change with the shows. So on both the things we covered today, there's plenty of adjustments, I'm sure. And we'll keep bringing you on to update people. I think these are important things for people to be aware of, even if, you know, you're a more product focused, maybe watch enthusiast. I think these things help give a little bit of context to what's going on. So thank you for joining us. Thank you for doing all the amazing research and reporting for this. Because it's really, I learn a ton, and I'm sure people listening did too.
All right, Stephen. Hoping for a better report next time.
Yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed, man.
All right.
Awesome. Thanks, Joe.
All right, bye-bye.
This week's episode was recorded remotely by our group of editors and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.